Brought to you by Leave the Ring Network. All boxing, no filter.
Oh! That's another knockdown.
He's not getting up, Jim.
He's not getting up. No, he's been knocked out.
It's over. Mamma mia, he's done it. Anthony Joshua defeats Vladimir Klitschko. AJ does it in style.
Beaten down, hopeless, without an answer, and Lomachenko has made Rigondeaux quit.
It's Fisgionados with Evan Rutkowski.
He's a good boy, you know.
Hello, fight fans. It is Thursday, January 2nd, and this is the Fisgionados podcast on the Leave It in the Ring radio network. I'm your host, Evan Rutkowski, former HBO sports marketing executive, giving you my take on what's happening in the sport of boxing on your screen and behind the scenes. Email me at fistinatos@yahoo.com. Follow me on Twitter at fistinatospod. We are brought to you by Ring Magazine and ringtv.com. Because this is my, I did it last year. God, it takes so long to put this together. I don't know if I'm going to do it again. I guess I'll just keep doing it if you guys like it. Let me know if you like this stuff. I had to split my deep dive up into two different episodes. I'm going to do my 2020 preview next episode. This one's going to run long. But, it's my review section for the entire year, basically. I show you how much it cost to partake in every single outlet, distribution option, so to speak, and what you got for it and whether it was worth it. So 2020 previews, I started doing that, and I'm just going to end up having to do that next. That'll be my deep dive next episode, I guess. And then let's get into it, because a lot happened. There was a lot to review. I got a lot to say about that stuff, and then we'll just get into the fun stuff. So, okay, let's start out with Friday, December 20th in Phoenix on DAZN. We have Daniel Jacobs beating Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. at Chavez weight in one of the more amazing TV performances we've seen in 2019. Basically just an all-out quit job by Chavez Jr. Also on the card, Julio Cesar Martinez beats Christopher Rosales by KO9, an incredible fight for a vacant WBC flyweight title. And then Mo Hooker wins his comeback fight by KO1 over Uriel Perez. Gabe Rosado, of course, ends up fighting in the walkout fight in front of an empty arena after being used to make an extra $1 million for Danny Jacobs in terms of leverage. This fight card started out really promising, and it kind of just ended up being like a freak show for boxing at its finest. And I am an admitted Chavez Jr. apologist, and we'll get into that. I think it's very easy to constantly rip him for every weird turn he's had in his career. And, he's ripped for being enabled and coddled. And, the constant critique is that he can get away with a lot of stuff that no other boxer could get away with. And all that stuff is true. And he quit here, which makes it really frustrating. The narrative so far from most boxing writers has been like, this should be Chavez Jr.'s last chance. I'm so fed up with him. Most of the core fans are fed up with him. My response to all this is Chavez Jr. is going to get another chance. Like, he is definitely going to get another chance. Every promoter at some point will fall in love with the guy, will see his potential for selling tickets and pay-per-views or subscriptions or whatever it is, and they're going to give this guy another chance. I don't know how many he has left, but here's the thing you have to understand. Among boxers, and quite frankly, among most athletes, period, their kids, especially if they're like a Hall of Famer, their kids will just likely not reach their level. And when you add in that dimension where it's like a national icon of the sport, which Chavez Sr. was, like, if Chavez Sr. was a soccer player, his son was talented enough to probably have just been a popular soccer player who could hack it in a lower level, in like the Mexican League or MLS or something like that, and carve out a career. Like, if you want to talk football. You've seen a couple examples of it. There's not too many, though. Like, in terms of who's playing today right now, I mean, like, Howie Long had a couple kids who were pretty good, but they were not, like, Hall of Famers by any means. You know, Ed McCaffrey, he had, like, four or five sons, and one of them is a superstar right now, but the rest of them are, like, they might get a cup of coffee with an NFL team, and Ed McCaffrey's not really a Hall of Famer or anything like that. There's a lot of examples of role players who had kids who turned out to be great. And I don't want to belabor the point here, because the overall point is, in boxing, this is a sport where, like, every single athlete comes from poverty or nothing, or, like, lower middle class, or as low of a middle class upbringing as you can get that is in poverty. You definitely don't see kids of rich, iconic people becoming stars. You just don't see it. Like, there are some examples of really good fighters who have kids who end up being pretty good. They're usually not fighters who made millions and millions of dollars, and they're definitely not fighters who are, like, national icons. And I think that my overall point with this is, where you do have to give Chavez Jr. a lot of credit is he actually learned how to box professionally, and he actually got to be pretty good. Like, his biggest accomplishments may end up being knocking out Andy Lee and having some, like, lower-level middleweight title defenses, and then obviously almost knocking out Sergio Martinez, and actually probably de facto ending Sergio's career. But, like, even when you look at that, I mean, his biggest – I don't want this to be a career look back on Chavez Jr., but, yeah, maybe all he was able to do is figure out how to lose a ton of weight, of water weight, rehydrate, and then kind of fight two weight classes above his opponents. And he actually kind of saw us in the first two or three rounds against Jacobs. Like, with any other last name, you can make an argument that Chavez Jr. is, like, a really good journeyman, like, somewhere in between that to, like, kind of an okay fighter who when he goes to the elite level, like, the truly, like, a good fighter who, when he goes to the elite level, like, just can't hack it. This is though the narrative amongst hardcore fans. To casuals, like, the fact is that this guy won a title, and he was actually able to compete with the elite fighters of his generation. And really, Canelo truly embarrassed him, but he didn't get embarrassed against a lot of the other guys. Like, I mean, he was on his way to getting embarrassed against Sergio. And I'm not saying he's an elite talent. Like, there's no question he's not. And he's not consistent, and he doesn't take things seriously unless there's a bright, shiny object at the end of the rainbow. But because of his last name, and because he's actually pretty good, like, he is a former titleist, and he actually did some pretty decent things, it's always going to be there for him. He means so much to the most consistent boxing crowd that is willing to tune in and buy pay-per-views. And there's just not many other Hall of Fame fighters who have kids who, you know, actually are good enough to fight in multiple pay-per-view fights and multiple prime spots on network TV. And like, a lot of this is just, you have to give Chavez Jr. credit that he actually learned how to fight at a pretty high pro level. And, you know, obviously, when he fought people, like, here's the thing. If you rewind to the beginning of this decade, there was a serious debate as to who was going to end up having the better pro career, Chavez Jr. or Canelo. And I think most people would have said Canelo was more talented, but Chavez Jr. probably had more momentum early on and didn't and looked better against probably the same level of competition. And just as a tool to bring boxing to casual Mexican-American fans, like, that's what you want. Like, those were the guys. And Chavez Jr. will still get more chances. You know, I think you could do a comeback in a different way, but it's not over for him. And stuff like this is embarrassing. Yeah, it is. But if you build it back in the right way, he's going to get more chances. I don't know why I spent, especially for this episode. Here's my overall thing. When you put Chavez Jr. on, the circus is coming to town. And if you do it right, you're going to sell a lot of pay-per-views and a lot of tickets and a lot of subscriptions. And if you do it wrong, it's going to be embarrassing. But because that potential exists for doing it right, he will get more chances. And the potential for that exists. Look, he has other siblings. They're just not as good as him. And I'm not saying he's elite. I'm saying he hit a point in his career where he got to be pretty dang good. All right, before we move on, the co-main event was incredible. And Dan Jacobs looked pretty good, although we didn't learn much about him except for the fact that he looked, you know, in terms of how he looked in the ring at 168, he looked pretty good. All right, enough on that. Let's move on. On Saturday, December 21st, on ESPN Plus from London, we have Daniel Dubois winning by KO2 versus Kyotaro Fujimoto at heavyweight. Liam Williams wins by KO5 against Alantes Fox. I don't have a whole lot to say about this one other than Daniel Dubois is very young. He might have another year in him in terms of just taking on these top 30-ish level heavyweight fights and like sort of continue that learning process. And I'm fine with that given his age. I'm more interested in seeing who his real first step-up fight is, and we can talk about that more when the time comes. But, I mean, this guy, for me, probably the best heavyweight prospect in the world right now. So he fights, I'm watching. All right. Also on Saturday, December 21st, we have Jermell Charlo beating Tony Harrison by KO11 in a rematch, and on Fox, in a rematch where Charlo reclaims his WBC junior middleweight title. Efe Ajagbe wins by KO5 over Iago Caladze at heavyweight, and then Rene Giron beats Carlos Balderas essentially twice by knocking him out. So for Fox, the entire show does an average of 1.65 million viewers, which isn't great, but when you add in the streaming and Fox Deportes, it gets up to 1.85 million, and then it peaks during the main event at 2.23 million. Must be noted, there was heavy competition, mostly because the NFL ran a triple header on Saturday, which just dominated the ratings, and then while Saturday Night Live didn't completely, it didn't directly compete with boxing, it did really, really well. You just got to throw that out there as a note. NFL Network, I think, had 8 of the top 10 shows on cable between the games they had and then the pre- and post-games they had. And I think the top 6 shows on cable outdrew everything on network TV except SNL. And, you know, the other networks, they didn't have super strong programming on to compete, but that's just because of what the NFL was doing. You know, the PBC boxing on Fox beat all the reruns on CBS in terms of total numbers and demos, which is great. You love to see that. ABC ran college football most of the day, and boxing actually compared pretty well there, which is impressive. The games during the day, like, just barely beat boxing. The night game beat it by a wider margin, but still didn't dominate. I think, like, the Las Vegas Bowl averaged, like, 2.6 million viewers and didn't have the greatest demos in the world. NBC ran all the usual Dateline material, which beat boxing in total viewership, but basically had the same demos. So even though that 1.65 million number is low, when you factor in everything else, actually a pretty decent night for PBC on Fox, especially if you look past the 10 p.m. hour and just isolate the main event. The actual fight card was great top to bottom, probably Fox's best card all year top to bottom. The main event was very entertaining clash of styles, and we learned a lot, probably not in a good way, about 2 of PBC's bigger prospects, but that's fun. I mean, usually these undercards just go the way they're supposed to, especially, and I'll get into this later, for PBC. In fact, when we, you know, like, Ajagbe was 50-1, so in fact, when you look at that, it's like, okay, like, I'm not sure what they were for Balderas, but I think he was like 7 or 8-1 or something like that, like a significant favorite. And we don't know how these are going to turn out. I mean, Balderas may end up just learning some valuable lessons from this and moving on and being good, but we don't know. This could kind of be the end, you know, the first fight for him where we learn he's not an elite fighter and he won't be, and, you know, the end is coming soon. Ajagbe was involved in one of the crazier sequences. I mean, it made great TV. Like, it looked like Caladze was almost out on his feet were doing some kind of weird Emmanuel Augustus drunking boxing thing, and he just like decked Ajagba. Ajagba recovered enough to win by KO, obviously. With him, you marvel at his body and athleticism. When you really... Athleticism is actually probably the wrong word. Like, for him especially, athleticism can be deceiving because you look at his body and you look at his frame and it's like he's got this Greek god body. He looks like a great heavyweight, but there's a stiffness and overall lack of fluidity. And I don't know. That is part of athleticism. That is. And to be fair to him, I think he still has a really high ceiling and huge potential. And I don't dig him too much for this because he's clearly still in the learning stage of his career. But it did bring up some signs where it's like, oh, some of this stuff that we maybe have seen before could come back to bite him if he doesn't learn. So hopefully he learns from it. You know, moving on to the main event, I don't do fight of the year lists officially, but you know, if you're making a list, I mean, this has to be in consideration for it. It was a great fight. If it's not, it's certainly on that second tier of fight of the year list. If it's not in the top three or four or five or whatever, what I found really impressive about it is just it wasn't just a brawl. There was a major strategic clash. There were tactical adjustments made through the fight. There was a great build up to it. It felt like a big fight. I mean, clearly there was a decent audience watching it on Fox. Great effort. Great effort from PBC. Let's move on and get through the review section. On Monday, December 23rd from Yokohama, Japan on ESPN Plus, we have Ryota Murata beating Stephen Butler by KO5 for Murata's WBA regular middleweight title. Also on the card, Kenshiro beats Randy Pettel-Corrin by KO4 to win his WBC or to retain his WBC junior flyweight title. Maruti Mathalain beats Akira Yagashi by KO9 to retain his IBF flyweight title. And then we saw Chocolatito winning by KO2 over DML Diokos. Really fun card top to bottom. One that had high-level boxing, lots of KOs, and there really was only one mismatch. I mean, I think Chocolatito was in a complete mismatch. And you got to ding ESPN Plus a little bit for showing the Chocolatito fight on delay, but not that much. I mean, everything else on this card was really good. Kenshiro, I mean, that was excellent. You know, the main event was good. I mean, Stephen Butler isn't the greatest opponent, I'd say. Like, it's still, like he's credible. I mean, he's not the greatest. If this is just a stay busy fight from Ronda and we see him come back quick, then you don't knock him any points at all. I mean, this was a really fun card. I don't know how. I mean, you start to hear like Canelo might go fight him in Japan. I don't know how Stephen Butler would get you that fight, but this ended up just being a really fun card to watch and pretty high level boxing. And I think, you know, Kenshiro, there's some buzz out there for that guy. He is really fun to watch. All right, let's move on to probably the most significant fight out of all these. On Saturday, December 28th, from Atlanta on Showtime, we ended the year with Gervonta Davis beating Yuriorkis Gamboa by KO12 to win a vacant WBA regular lightweight title. Kind of a BS title, but at some point might not be a BS title. I don't know. Also on the card, Jean Pascal beats Badou Jack for Pascal's WBA regular lightweight title that has debatable lineage as well. And then Lionel Thompson beats Jose Uzkateki at super middleweight. The Showtime cards get split into individual events per fight where they are rated, but the ratings were as follows. Main event averaged 577,000 viewers and was the number 14 cable show of the day. The undercards averaged 471 and 482,000 viewers, and they were the number 18 and 19 cable shows of the day. The main event peaked at just over 600,000 viewers. Some important things jump out at you when you look at these numbers. First of all, how high it ranked. It was the number 14 show of the day, and that's because it was up against the college football semifinals, which did bonkers numbers on cable. The Clemson-Ohio State game averaged over 20 million viewers, and literally the top 13 cable shows of the day were on ESPN and were somehow college football related. They were either the semifinal games. I think there was one other bowl game. There were the pre and post games. There was the Sports Center that came on directly after. So Gervonta Davis was actually the top-rated cable show of the day that wasn't ESPN college football related. Pretty impressive. Pretty impressive. Another thing that was just when you look at the female demos that Davis did for boxing, they're really strong. Like, he did really well in there for boxing. When you look at the social metrics for Davis's fight, they did really well. I mean, he basically, you know, again, didn't go viral, but sort of what you would consider viral for boxing. Like, there are a few different posts that did that. Obviously, the hip-hop community really comes out for Davis. Like, you can, you know, sort of see just by the social activity and who's in the crowd, who's paying attention. You know, just that crowd is there, which is incredible. I mean, it's another audience for him that is, you know, can push him into the mainstream a lot more. I did see a lot of social media debate about ticket sales for Davis on Boxing Twitter, which is not a place I try to spend a lot of time. But hey, I'm doing this podcast, so I guess I'm there. And here's the thing. Most fighters who are quote-unquote draws are able to do it in their hometown or one specific market. Maybe they can do it in two markets. You know, it translates to other cities maybe if there's concerted effort put in. So Davis drew okay in the beginning of this year in LA, like solid, like pretty good, okay. Certainly good for not living there. Then he did really well in Baltimore, which is his hometown. And now he does really well in Atlanta, which also had a major college football game taking place in the city that same day. And Atlanta has never been a boxing market. And many people in the boxing industry have noted how strong of a potential there is to be one. And I think that's really just because it has a high, well-educated, affluent African-American population. It ranks among, you know, quite frankly, it never ranks that high in terms of being a top pay-per-view market. Like, it doesn't over-index, I guess I should say, like, for its population or anything like that, for TV ratings or pay-per-view. You know, I think you could say that because there's sort of this hip-hop community there and because of the aforementioned connection that Davis has with that community, that's maybe why it did well. But Davis drew well there. And he drew well in a city that has very little track record of coming out for boxing. And Davis did pretty well in three different cities without significant opponents in 2019. There's a lot of talk of him going to pay-per-view next, and I don't know if that is definitely the best move for him next. I mean, clearly, he probably could do it at this point. He has the potential to draw a pay-per-view audience that are not core boxing fans, which is what you need to make that jump. That's extremely important. And I think, you know, also, we haven't seen him against a top flight opponent. I think with a top flight opponent, he could do pay-per-view and he could do okay there. You did see a few things with him that are signs for concern. I mean, he missed weight on his initial attempt while moving up in weight. I don't ding him too much for that. I think anytime you change weight classes, it's always going to be tough. But obviously, there have been a lot of pictures of him in between training not looking great, so you kind of have to wonder with him a little bit on that. Gibbo is a lot older, and while he did put on a good performance like Davis, you could make an argument you probably should have gotten rid of him faster. But look, I don't ding him too much on this. I think he looked pretty good. I think this is a learning experience. Overall, the card for Showtime was very entertaining. It definitely brought back some hope. I mean, that Pascal Jack undercard for me was the first time in 2019 that we saw an undercard, which we regularly saw in the first half of 2018. I think it's a big win for them to close out the year at a time, you know, when a lot of people are ready to basically bury them as a network. All right. For the deep dive, like I said up top, I'm doing a year-end review show. What kind of value you got as a subscriber, viewer, purchaser of whatever these boxing entities had to offer. I'll go through Showtime and ESPN, ESPN Plus, and pay-per-view, and Fox, and FS1, Fox pay-per-view, DAZN, everything. And what I'll list the fight cards, and I'll make a note if there were undercards that were significant. And what I really want to establish here is just the notion of, like, is the boxing working for you as a consumer? How much you're paying for it, what level of boxing it is, and then kind of is it working for the network? Although I think I'll now be getting more into that next episode, you know, 2020 preview, and I'll focus more, less on the consumer. I think this one, just because of how long it's going to end up being, I'll focus on the consumer for this one, and I'll focus on the networks next one. So a few upfront things for pay-per-views. I'm just going to go with the suggested retail price, which I think was $75 for every single one of them this year. It must be noted that not every cable system charges that. Like Spectrum in LA, for instance, charges $65 for a pay-per-view. You know, I'm going to list what the cable companies pay for the ESPNs and FS1s of the world. I'm going to give a grade for each of the offer, you know, for their offerings. But it's kind of a tough grade to give in a lot of instances. I mean, Fox, for example, we'll get into it. It shows on Big Fox, FS1, and pay-per-view. A lot of other distributors had different categories as well. I think this helps add a little nuance, but it's tough. You almost have to either give every single different thing they're doing a grade or just give, you know, one grade overall. Another thing, when I go through these lists, most of the time, I'm just either going off of what a PR person sent me or what the website says for these things. So I'm aggregating this stuff. So if I missed a card or a special undercard fight, like mea culpa to the entity where it happens, but it takes a long time to put this podcast, this particular podcast episode just takes a long time to put it together, you know. Okay, let's start out with last year's top scorer. Showtime got an A- last year for me in terms of value. Needless to say, they will not get that this year. To subscribe to Showtime, you can get it for $12 a month, so $144 a year. That is the streaming version, and I guess depending on how big of a cable package you get, you might say you get it for a little bit more, a little bit less, but let's stick with that number for right now. Showtime did one pay-per-view, the Pacquiao-Broner pay-per-view. It cost $75. So for the year for Showtime, you either paid $144 or $219. I would say most people probably would not consider Showtime as a sunk cost based on what type of cable package they have. You know, for me personally, I only watch one or two other shows besides boxing, and I would definitely cancel Showtime if it weren't for boxing. So the pay-per-view did okay. It did around 400,000 buys by most estimates. And given the question marks around Manny Pacquiao coming into this year, was that, you know, that's pretty good. I mean, there wasn't a significant undercard there. But, it, you know, and most people kind of knew how this one would go. There were some entertaining all-access episodes in the build-up, though. I'll give Showtime that. That's part of what you're paying for. On the actual pay cable boxing side, Showtime had Gervonta Davis fighting Hugo Ruiz in February. They also had the DeGale Eubank Jr. card in February. They had Laura Castaño in March. They had Easter Bartholomew in April. They had Wilder Brazil in May, which also had Gary Russell Jr. in a mismatch, and they had a fun opener, so that did have some good undercards. June brought us Charlo Brandon Adams. July brought us Gervonta Davis versus Ricardo Nunez. And then there was the Gamboa Martinez undercard fight. There was no high-level boxing in August or September. October brought us the Lubin Gallimore card. Nothing in November, but we do have two December cards, which were Charlo Hogan and then Davis Gamboa, which, as I mentioned above, was one of the better cards that we saw all year in terms of a really entertaining undercard, a star fighter. I think that was good. So we saw a huge rise in the number of Showbox cards this year, some of which turned out to be really entertaining. I mean, we had the one Clarissa Shields card in April, and then obviously there was one in, I think, August that just didn't end up happening because of that weighing craziness. In terms of overall grade, I mean, Showtime took a major step back this year as a network. I've said this a million times on this podcast and in other places, but 2018 was a banner year for them. And, you know, 2019, they just really didn't have too much to show for it. We got a lot of, basically, we had a few stars fighting. We got one Deontay Wilder appearance, a few Charlo Brothers appearances, three Gervonta Davis appearances, all in fights where he was heavily favored. I mean, especially with Davis, I will say, you can make a case that with him, you know, that he was a prohibitive favorite. That was all a negative thing. But I actually think Showtime and PBC, and I talked about this a little bit earlier, they did an excellent job of building him as a brand this year. So I don't knock Showtime. First of all, I don't knock them for the February mismatch because that was supposed to be Abner Morris. He drew well in three different cities. There were great storylines like on TV for him. You know, he's now close to where you can make that jump to pay-per-view. And I think anytime a network does that, they deserve some credit for it. But that tangent aside, I mean, I think the real knock here of the main events for Showtime is a lot of them would have been undercards on Showtime in 2018. If we look at 2019 versus 2018. And we'll get into Fox in a second, but I mean, some of Showtime's headlining fights were like, they're similar quality to maybe even a couple FS1 main events. And there just weren't too many competitive main events. Way too many showcase fights. There were some competitive undercards, I'll give them that. But very rarely did we see those lead to other significant fights, which is something that 2018 Showtime did really, really well. And the drop in viewership on boxing on Showtime was precipitous this year. And I think we're at the point where every show on Big Fox, almost every show on ESPN, I mean, a lot of the shows on FS1 will outrate Showtime's in terms of viewership. You know, obviously, Tank Davis and Wilder were bright spots, both in terms of star power and viewership numbers. But the fight cards that didn't involve them saw real atrophy. I mean, DAZN and ESPN Plus will now basically tell you off the record that they outrate many of the Showtime shows, and they're probably not wrong by saying that. You know, Fox has publicly said that they have the preferred PBC deal. You know, and you know, they're basically saying like Showtime gets our second choice. I mean, those are the negatives. Those are the negatives when you look at that. And to what extent that's true, I don't know. When you look at the positives, when I say that, I'm saying that really about the Fox stuff. I mean, the Fox is publicly saying that, and there's no question for the pay-per-views, they're right. And I think they've probably put on, well, we'll get to Fox. They've put on some really good fights. I mean, they're probably right by saying that. If you look at the positives, though, Showtime has had down years before. Like, they've had negative years before. They've always come back. You know, and if you are one of the people who thinks that Showtime is just going to leave the sport after this year, then this is like the downward slope to that happening. But if you think they're going to be here in 10 years, I mean, this is just another, this is a blip on the radar. And, you know, a few years from now, maybe DAZN is out of the picture. You know, maybe Showtime had a weird year or two when they figured out their relationship and strategy with Fox, but they probably will and get a more balanced package of programming. You know, I also think Showtime, they need to start reframing the Nielsen numbers, because although their viewership has gone way down, I am certainly one of what I assume to be a growing number of people that will stream Showtime rather than watch it on linear TV. The numbers aren't encouraging. They were never fantastic on Showtime, especially compared to HBO back in the day. So it's not like there's been this humongous drop over the past 8 or 10 years or anything like that. You know, and what I would say is, while many in the industry assume that Showtime, like I said, might be out of boxing in 2021, I actually think there's a really strong pathway for them to have a rebound year, like a very strong rebound year in 2020. I'm going to give them a C minus for 2019, and I probably would have given them a D plus, but I think their December was strong enough to raise that grade. They still have, in my opinion, the strongest announcing team. They have the strongest production quality, which does count for something. I think that, you know, the December 28th card was really strong. Overall, there were too many undercard fights, you know, that weren't up to the quality of what we've seen in the past. There were too many mismatches this year. That's why they get the lower grade. But that's what I'll give them. That's what I'm sticking with. I do think, you know, I'll get into this more next episode. I'm not necessarily predicting that they'll have an amazing comeback year in 2020, but I do think there are major pathways to seeing that. And I'll get into those reasons next episode. All right, while we're on PBC, let's move over to Fox. Regular Fox is free for everyone. FS1 is part of most standard cable packages that, although you might have to pay extra for, you know, if it's a sports package to get it, many times you don't. I think they charge $1.86 a month in terms of what the cable companies actually pay for it, so take that for what it's worth. There were four pay-per-views on Fox at a suggested retail price of $75 each. So if you are the boxing consumer that just buys everything, you probably view this as $300 over the course of the year. And if FS1 is not a sunk cost for you, maybe we can technically say it's $325. You obviously are spending less if you're a more discerning pay-per-view customer. Let's go through Fox's content. All right, so we had on Fox pay-per-view Garcia Spence in March. We have Pacquiao Thurman in July. Spence Porter in September. Wilder Ortiz 2 in November. Most of these had pretty strong undercards for pay-per-view fights, which I think must be noted. You know, and overall, it's a pretty decent pay-per-view lineup. I mean, in terms of overperforming or underperforming, Wilder Ortiz 2 was the only true dud. It really underperformed at the box office. Garcia Spence and Spence Porter, for me, get bonus points because not only did Fox do pretty well on them, but PBC, clearly they made money on them. They were fiscally responsible when it comes to that. I mean, obviously, with Pacquiao signed a deal where he got paid so much that I don't think anybody made money on him this year. The numbers just weren't, you know, it's 500,000. And I, by the way, I don't think Pacquiao Thurman did hit 500,000. But it's, there were no, you know, you probably could have made a case it should have done better. There were no breakout stars. And I think they've all been good fights. Like Pacquiao Thurman was a really good fight. Like it was a really great fight. In terms of the commercial aspect of it, which is really how pay-per-views get judged, I've talked about this at length on this podcast. If you listen to it all year, you know, with regards to how the pay-per-views have been marketed. And I think that change is probably going to be looked at as a bright spot or a really potentially great bright spot once they finally develop a true pay-per-view superstar where whoever it ends up being is just a huge draw and can reach that 800,000, 900,000, 1 million buy mark pretty regularly. And I think on that aspect, if you're going to ding Fox on the pay-per-view side, you'd point out, hey, Showtime did a much better job in terms of selling pay-per-view just from a purely artistic standpoint. They created much stronger social shoulder programming. You know, and like I said, there's just not that breakout star yet. I mean, that's not really Fox's fault because they haven't had a chance to build an individual fighter, and these things can be cyclical in boxing, but look, we didn't have a pay-per-view fight break 500,000 buys this year. I can't even really remember the last time that happened. I mean, I feel like there have been very few years where there hasn't been a pay-per-view hit the million buy mark. And it didn't happen this year. And that's not all Fox's fault. That's not all anybody's in particular's fault. I mean, that's kind of the way how it happened. I guess if it's anybody's fault, it's DAZN's fault. And to see, I think on the positive side, just to see how Fox can blast out the awareness during NFL games, it's it's like a superpower that I could have only dreamed of back in the day. You know, again, I've been over the negatives to that ad nauseum. Let's go to Big Fox. I mean, we had Thurman Lopez in January, which also had Kamaski Washington on it. It had that like Nambiar Marrero on the undercard. Santa Cruz Rivera was in February, Porter Ugas in March, Garcia Granados in April, Herd Williams in May, Charlo Cota in June. Plant versus Lee was part of that pay-per-view undercard in July. Kanaski Areola and Lara Alvarez were in August. Harrison Charlo 2 was in December. So for free TV, this is a pretty strong showing, or at least it's a strong showing in spots. There's obviously a couple of just pure duds here. But you got to mention Herd Williams and Harrison Charlo 2 as Fight of the Year candidates, or at least in that, like, next tier. If your first tier only has three or four fights, it's in the they're both top 10 fights of the year, really. I really like the Kanaski Areola fight as well. I thought that was an awesome fight. Porter Ugas turned out to be well matched on paper. I mean, kind of boring on TV in practice, but it was a lauded fight on paper when much of this got announced. And, you know, I actually think Thurman Lopez ended up being pretty fun in practice, and it had a star at least. So there's a lot to say. You know, in addition, you go back to that promoting these fights on the air, especially during football games, which did some that helped some of these things do really strong numbers. I mean, the viewership levels for the top fights, they were solid, not spectacular. I think there's repeatable success here. You know, I think it just needs to, you just need to say, like, this is free and this is on Fox and between on network TV, where just more people watch network TV than anything else. All that stuff is positive. All that stuff is positive. There was a commitment to shoulder programming on both Fox and FS1 that was pretty strong. Those are all the good parts. I mean, the negatives, like, when you look at the inconsistent nature of some of the fights on Fox, like Santa Cruz Rivera, Garcia Granados, Lara Alvarez, and those are either subpar. If you want to talk cynical, I mean, Caleb Plant, Mike Lee, I don't know how you want to judge, because that one's like a pay-per-view undercard fight, but that's just, that's just so bad. Charlo Cota, you get a little bit of a pass there because there was an injury involved, but, you know, when you go to the undercards, most of the undercards fights, they're just showcase fights, or they're vets in fights that aren't necessarily going to be fights that lead to fights that aren't super meaningful. Now, look, you did get cases sometimes like the Harrison Charlo 2 card where we learned a lot about Carlos Balderas. Those were really good, obviously. The shoulder programming here is prolific, but for me, just not that good for the most part. You know, I'll give two examples here. And when I say good, I mean, HBO and Showtime set a standard for this where it's just hard to match. And these companies aren't built to do this kind of programming to truly sell pay-per-views and to truly sell big-time boxing. They're just not built to do it. I'll give a couple examples here. So, like, the Fight Camp shows a lot of times they did were, I would say, they're of the same quality that a lot of, like, the Barker shows were at HBO that we did, which were, like, the 30-minute documentary shows, which, you know, were lower budget. You spent less time with these guys. Like, it's just, you know, again, they're just not built to do this kind of stuff. Showtime's All Access is just better. I think it's just higher quality. Like, the Face-Off shows, and look, I love me some Brian Campbell doing the Face-Off shows. He did a great job hosting. When you look at this concept as built as a build-up show for every single main event, I mean, they did so many of those shows. I just question the philosophy behind that. I mean, we did these sporadically at HBO, and it kind of needed to be like a really big main event, or there needed to be some true animosity for the concept to work. And when it works, like, it works really, really well, but it kind of loses some of the flavor. You know, it loses that special quality when you do one for every single fight, basically, it just ceases to be special. So specifically to the ratings, like, the demos were really not that good. When they put on bad cards, like, the demos and the ratings were just bad. Like they just reruns on other networks routinely beat Fox. And, you know, I think the biggest disappointment was the opportunity cost, where, like, Fox and PBC just didn't take the chance of going for a big time, like, a really big TV audience that it would have meant probably breaking the pay scale a bit and providing some, like, a close to pay-per-view quality fight on the network. I think with their platform and with the way they can market these fights, with the, especially with the NFL audience, and they can put on a fight that's going to have the biggest audience boxing's had in like 20 or 30 years if they did that right. And if it, you know, if they needed to cut some money out of shoulder programming, I would say do it. I would say one of those would be just a truly great experiment. But, you know, they're doing fine with this. And you got to remember, this stuff's free. And they're putting on, like, half their cards this year were pretty good. Like, and the ones they did right, they did really, really well with. All right, let's go to FS1. FS1 had Plant Uzgatecki in January, Durrell Yildirim in February, Peterson Lipinets in March, which also had Anthony Peterson versus Argenis Mendez on it, Quillen Truax in April, which I think had an undercard or two that was pretty good, Trout Gachet in May, Alexander Redcatch in June, James DeMarco in July, Figueroa Chacon in August, Quillen Angulo in September, Castaño Omotoso in November. You know, and there were some fun undercards on some of these, but most of what we got on this level with FS1 were prospects winning by wide decisions or KOs. I mean, look, I have a lot of complaints on the macro level of how these cards are run. I mean, let's just do the negatives first. Like, these shows, for me, were just, like, logistical. I mean, nightmare is a strong word, but these things were consistently starting late. They would take forever in the pacing. I mean, I complained above about the streaming stuff. This was almost even worse. I mean, many times there were just two or three pointless undercards fights that were, like, borderline embarrassing, where you're hearing some guy, you know, what was the one classic example? Like, the guy is a waiter at Applebee's or something like that, and you know, you just look at him and he's just not going anywhere. And it's not even like these are two journeyman boxers who are true pros who have the potential to put on, if you match them up well, like, maybe not Gotti Ward, but that type of fight. Here, you know, we just saw too much of, like, stuff that shouldn't be on TV. I had way too much Joey Spencer in my life. You know, these are the kind of things. And Joey Spencer, good prospect. There is a reason why there are portions of decent prospects' careers that are not on TV, because they're learning experiences. And we just saw too much of that on FS1. Now, that all being said, and the reason I'm vociferously complaining about this, like, these are hours of my life that I'm just not getting back. Like, the main events were pretty freaking strong for these, for, like, FS1 fights. I mean, honestly, like I said, you can make a case that minus the Tank Davis and Wilder fights on Showtime this year, if you were just given the choice of watching main events on Showtime versus this list of main events, it's kind of close. Like, it's closer than you think. And, you know, the viewership numbers for these things are low, but actually, I think this is a bright spot compared to other programming on FS1. I mean, they're really not bad at all. Like, they built on some MLB games, especially towards the end of the year. And look, the audiences, like, these kind of fights with these kind of audiences, they're not going to mean a ton to advertisers. You know, so when you compare boxing on FS1 to other sports that really draw big-time audiences, like football or racing, like, they're just, advertisers aren't going to care about this. But And some of that's not fair. I mean, FS1's kind of, I think it started out as the speed network. So the racing stuff is like, you're going to see huge numbers there. But boxing, I mean, compared to a lot of the other programming outside of like the truly top level stuff that FS1 had, boxing was pretty good. And I mean, I think they can take this formula and fit, you know, make some adjustments on the pacing of everything. This can really be something good. I mean, the value you got for FS1, this is the classic example of my biggest complaint about 2019. Like, you just got a tonnage and no curation. But if you actually just went through and curated FS1, it was really strong this year. So overall for Fox, they're doing so many different things that it's hard to just give them a grade that encompasses everything. I'm going to go with a B+ overall. I mean, the regular, like I said, inconsistent, but there was good stuff on regular Fox. That's just on its own is the best value because it's free. All the pay-per-views, I mean, they made a lot of great fights on pay-per-view. You know, Spence Porter and Pacquiao Thurman were really, really good fights. I mean, Wilder Ortiz, too, is at least very interesting, and I think you can make the same case. I wasn't too excited about Garcia Spence going in because I thought it was a total mismatch. But still, it was a big fight. You know, I wish they would have figured out how to do one less pay-per-view and added depth to other cards. Like, that would have helped out some of my complaints. You probably would have seen a trickle-down effect that would have really helped out. I mean, it's tough to give them too low of a grade because a lot of the stuff they're putting on for free. But even that, it doesn't tell the whole story. I mean, Fox just, it's pretty impressive. And this is one of the things that I think Top Rank, they won't get as high of a grade this year that they did last year. But if you look at what PBC and Top Rank are doing just on a logistical level, it's really impressive. I mean, they went, these companies 3 years ago were like surviving off 10 or 12 dates on HBO or Showtime, you know, not even that for Top Rank. And now, like, PBC is 10 Fox dates, 12 FS1 dates, 4 pay-per-views, and then the Showtime dates, too. I mean, it's just so hard to put that much programming on, especially where it's all good. So you got to cut them a little bit of slack. I mean, you know, again, the FS1 stuff is just, like, a total waste of viewing time for me on some of the undercards. And same with Big Fox, too. Like, some of those undercards weren't great. But the pay-per-views they were $75 a pop. I mean, my biggest note here is they gave us a lot of the fights that we did want to see. It's just that most of them were on pay-per-view, and that's fine. The inconsistencies were a little bit tough, but B+ is still a really strong grade. All right, let's move on to ESPN. The ESPN math here is a little fuzzy. I mean, the pay-per-view was $75, and then ESPN Plus is $49.99 for the year or $4.99 a month, depending on what you want to do. Where it gets a little fuzzy, ESPN itself is pretty much part of every single basic cable package. And I think they charge the cable companies like $7 a month. I think next year it moves to $9. Maybe I'm wrong on that. That might be all the ESPN channels combined. But I mean, similar to FS1, I think most people who are sports fans and cable subscribers just kind of view this as a sunk cost. So maybe if you bought everything from ESPN, you know, the pay-per-view was $75, ESPN Plus is $50, so that's $125. You know, if you want to get super technical, we can maybe call it another $7 a month, you know, for the cable package, so it comes to either $125, $210 total. I guess depends what you actually are spending your money on. All right, ESPN. It had nothing in January, but had the Oscar Valdez, Thomas Sohn, and then Richard Comey, Chania fights in February. They were the undercards to the Kovalev-Alvarez rematch. Then it had Ramirez-Zepeda, which had a good, fun undercard, Beltran-Okada. And then it had Brandt Bisenguroff in February as well. In March, they had Pulev Dinu, Vazdik Ngubu, Mean Machine Ray Robinson was on that undercard. In May, there was Beterbiev Kalajic, and then Burchelt Vargas and Navarrete Dogbo, as well as Ito Herring. In June, Valdez Sanchez, Comey Beltran. Later in June, in July, Stevenson fought Guevara. In August, Navarrete De Vaca. Nothing in September. In October, Beterbiev fought Vostick, which is excellent, by the way. In November, Burchelt fought Sosa, and then in December, the post-Heisman card where Crawford fought Mean Machine, Teofimo Lopez fought Comey, and there was the Conlan Nikitin card. The pay-per-view in April, we had Crawford fighting Mir Khan, Stevenson fighting Lopez separately, or Stevenson and Lopez fighting separately on the undercards. I'll just run through ESPN Plus real quick because I think for ESPN, it's worth hearing both because I think one is just clearly superior to the other. ESPN Plus in January had Jennings Rivas, which that card also had Stevenson Rosales on it. In February, the Alvarez-Kovalev rematch happened with Teofimo Lopez against Magdaleno in the undercard. In March, it had an Anthony Yard card with Liam Williams and Daniel Dubois on. There was a good Michael Conlan fight with a pretty good undercard, Colazzo versus Samuel Vargas on. In April, there was Lomachenko-Krolla. There was another Daniel Dubois fight. In May, there was a card with BJ Saunders and Joe Joyce on it. In June, Josh Warrington, Cade Galahad. There was the Tyson Fury Schwartz card, which also had a pretty good undercard, Jesse Hart, Sullivan Barrera. I'm leaving out a ton of MTK Global cards featuring guys like Stephen Ward, Lee McGregor, Ryan Walsh, that kind of level of fighter fighting around the world. In July, we had Rob Brandt against Ryota Murata in a rematch. In that rematch, plus Ken Shiro was on the undercard. We had Daniel Dubois against Nathan Gorman, which I thought was a very solid UK heavyweight matchup of prospects. Joe Joyce, Brian Jennings also on that card. Later in July, we saw Teofimo Lopez fight Nakatani. We had a Michael Conlan fight in August. We had that weird Jason Sosa card that was supposed to be Carl Frampton's return. August also had Kovalev Yard from Russia, which had a decent undercard. Lomachenko, Luke Campbell, which had, and maybe not the most TV-friendly undercard, but some, you know, Povetkin was on there. In September, Fury Wallen, Navarrete Elorde, and Pedraza Zepeda was on that undercard. Another Daniel Dubois fight, a host of MTK cards, including like a Josh Warrington easy defense. Then in October, we got Stevenson Joette Gonzalez. In November, we got Jamel Herring, Lamont Roach. I'm leaving out a ton more MTK Global cards. There was that great card that wasn't, I didn't think it'd be great, but Oscar Valdez fought Adam Lopez. Carl Frampton fought on that card, and the Adamas Teixeira card. Teixeira fight was on that card, too. There was that Navarrete card from Mexico to close out the year. Then there was Daniel Dubois, Fujimoto, and that awesome Japanese card that had Murata, Butler, Kenshiro, and Higashi, you know, Mafalane and Higashi. So to me, it's pretty clear that ESPN has just put the Disney / ESPN on the whole has put a larger focus on ESPN Plus being successful, and you're just seeing you're seeing that play out. I mean, if you look at ESPN Plus in just in terms of pure value for $49 that you're getting as a boxing fan, I mean, it's just so hard to go through that schedule and say, oh, that's not worth it. Like, this is incredible value. Like, you get a ton of foreign fights, you know, some not so good, but some really good, if not great. And then you get a pretty robust schedule of Top Rank put a lot of their stars on ESPN Plus. They put a lot of pretty good fights on ESPN Plus. I mean, basically, if one of their stars fights in a foreign fight, at least in 2019, you could just book it. It would be on ESPN Plus. They did a lot of developmental fights for their rising stars on ESPN Plus. I mean, if I was just giving the grade for ESPN Plus alone, it'd probably be like A minus B plus territory. I do have a couple major qualms. One of which is there just isn't a true articulation of what type of fight card belongs on ESPN Plus and what type of fight card belongs on ESPN. And look, to be fair to them, that may not matter much. But you know, the tangential part of that, sort of the cousin of that, which is really my second qualm, is that they just don't take advantage of ESPN Plus as a streaming platform for the viewing experience. And I guess that, like I said, it's like a cousin of what belongs on ESPN and what belongs on ESPN Plus. Like, on ESPN Plus, there's no live sporting shows that can run late. There's no lead-in. There's no commercials that, like, there are commercials, but there's no commercial-specific break time that's required. Like, you don't have to hit certain marks on certain things. And I guess all too often, we've just seen shows where there's long breaks in between fights. The pacing is, like, exactly like it would be for a regular ESPN boxing card. And I just think on the streaming platform, these things should move fast. Like, we should get in and out. We don't need too much waiting time between fights. Especially with this much boxing on TV, I really value my time. I don't like waiting long in between fights. And this is a common complaint for everything, but I think especially on a streaming platform, there's just no reason for it to take this long. Those things are significant for ESPN Plus, but honestly, as we move to ESPN, I mean, you just can't, you got to lower the grade, because the fights that were on linear ESPN, they just weren't of the same caliber as the fights on ESPN Plus, and they're definitely not on the same level that ESPN made in 2018. Like, there's just too many fights that were long odds coming in. We knew one guy was really good, and we may not have heard of the other guy. And there were fighters that I just don't consider to be major talents who are fighting in main events. Overall, I'm going to say, like, B-minus for ESPN this year in the terms of the total grade. Not as good of a year as 2018. You know, I'd probably shade it closer to B-minus. What I will say is this was a transitional year where we saw a lot of top prospects at Top Rank fight a ton. And it's set up pretty well for them in terms of making big events in 2020. I mean, I think that's, like, if I had another complaint, that would be it, that there were just, there weren't enough marquee big fights that were clearly distinguished from the rest of them. And some of that is that they had to just give a lot of PR time to Tyson Fury, and understandably so. But he wasn't in great fights. And so the other stuff, you know, like, a lot of Top Rank's big names just weren't in huge fights in 2019. But the thing is, a lot of them probably will be in 2020. And I don't want to touch too much on that because that is going to infringe on my next episode. But, like, I think a lot of their guys, especially their younger fighters, made significant steps forward in 2019. And you can view that as a major positive. You saw all these guys fight frequently, and you saw them develop. But, you know, we're in that B minus territory for ESPN. I don't think they did as well as Fox this year. But I think still, especially with the ESPN Plus, a very strong showing. I mean, look, we're in a golden age for viewing boxing. And I think it goes back to, it's one of the things that I mentioned about PBC. Just, it's so impressive that Top Rank, like, this company that only a couple years ago was able to put up this many fights. And granted, you know, a lot of them, like I said, complain about inconsistent quality with them. But that's just naturally going to happen because these companies weren't built, like, these kind of promotional companies weren't built to put on this many fights, quite frankly. It's just so many, and they're doing a pretty good job with it. Now, let's move on. Let's go to DAZN. I'm going to divide DAZN fights into three categories. There's Matchroom cards, there's Golden Boy cards, and then there's World Boxing Super Series cards. Let's go with Matchroom first. They had, in January, the Andrade Akhavov card. There was Gil Dominguez, Bivol Smith Jr., and Farmer Carroll early on. I'm only going to mention the prominent UK card, so I'll mention Liam Smith versus Sam Eggington in that category. That was January, February, March. Not that impressive, to be perfectly honest, to say the least, I'd say. Finally, in April, we got a good card with Sarisa Ketsuo-Rungvisai versus Juan Francisco Estrada. The undercard for that was a rematch. The undercard for that was amazing. Like, Roman Doheny is like probably the hipster fight of the year. There was Vargas Soto. In May, we had Devin Haney versus Antonio Moran. We had AJ versus Andy Ruiz 1 in June, which had some really prominent undercards. We had Golovkin Rolls after that, which was technically under Triple G Boxing, but now Eddie Hearn is going to be involved in all Triple G's fights. Later in June, we had Andre Sulecki. Then we had Dillian White versus Oscar Rivas. Then Mo Hooker, Jose Ramirez. Estrada Beeman was in August. Devin Haney versus Zaur Abdulev, which actually had, I think, a decent undercard fight on it. That was the Heather Hardy Serrano fight, right? Matchroom put on Golovkin Derevchenko after that, which was a fight of the year type deal. Usyk Witherspoon, that was okay. From the UK, Progray Taylor, which they promoted. Obviously, that was World Boxing Super Series as well. In November, we got KSI Logan Paul 2, and BJ Saunders, Devin Haney were on that undercard. From the UK, we got Callum Smith, John Ryder. And finally, in December, we had AJ Ruiz 2 and then the Jacobs Chavez Jr. card, which I've gone over ad nauseum with that pretty strong undercard fight. Okay, Golden Boy gave us Munguia Inoue, which also had that Zucan Rojas fight on it. Machado Cancio 1, Ryan Garcia versus Jose Lopez, then Munguia versus Hogan, then Canelo versus Jacobs, which had a pretty strong undercard. In June, we got Cancio versus Machado 2. In July, Vargas Camedo, which had some really good undercard fights on it. In August, we had Virgil Ortiz Jr. versus Antonio Rosco, then Munguia Alote in September, Canelo Kovalev, and finally Virgil Ortiz Jr. versus Brad Solomon in December. The World Boxing Super Series in April gave us Prograde versus Kirill Relic, Donaire in that substitute fight, Taylor Branchik, Inoue Rodriguez, Reyes Golaki, Dorticos Tabidi, Prograde Taylor, and then Donaire Inoue. We're waiting on the cruiserweights. I think a few things pop out with DAZN when you look at their schedule this way. First of all, is just how much more they rely on Matchroom than Golden Boy, which I can assure you that when Canelo signed, that was not really the plan. And Golden Boy did actually have some stronger sort of second tier cards, like tier two, let's call it, where we saw some really well-matched fights all the way through the cards. I mean, there were a couple of those where there were some of those where there were like three or four good fights on there where their prospects really got tested. Some of them got, sometimes they got beat. You know, we didn't see that. I mean, you've heard me basically complain about undercard fights all the way through. Shout out to Golden Boy for actually putting on good undercard fights, basically. At least in some of the cards, not all of them. The Matchroom cards were inconsistent, but when they did it right, it was excellent. I mean, that April 26th card with Roman Doheny, SSR Estrada, Jesse Vargas, Humberto Soto, like, that was awesome. And there were other fights down on that card that were great, too. AJ Ruiz 1 and 2 felt like really big events. Hearn deserves a lot of credit for that. You got to love that Mo Hooker-Jose Ramirez fight. And that's really impressive considering both fighters weren't even that known 2 years ago. Overall, it took a few months, but once DAZN put it together and it kind of mixed everything together, it was pretty impressive. Another thing you have to look at with DAZN, how much they relied on the World Boxing Super Series for competitive fights. These are fight cards that are built. They're just fights in general that are built for the core fan base. Like, they actually have fights leading to fights. They create stars. It's great matchups. And it's not to say that DAZN didn't have competitive fights without these, but when you go one step below, like the Canelo and AJ fights, the World Boxing Super Series just produced so many of those competitive sort of old school HBO World Championship Boxing type of fights where it clearly wasn't a pay-per-view, but it was also like a perfect version of a top-level fight that you get on a network where it wasn't a showcase. It's just, that's impressive. Another thing you notice when you look at this is just how star-driven Golden Boy is. I mean, they basically have Canelo, they have Ryan Garcia, Virgil Ortiz, Jaime Munguia, and that's it. And I love watching the Zucans and Andrew Cancios of the world, but like, where is this thing going in terms of like star fighters? I mean, okay, so you look at DAZN on the whole, it's just clearly the best value. I mean, at $99 per year, it's just really not even close in terms of the value you get for your subscription. I'll give it an A- just for that. If you just look at who made the best fights, it's probably them as well, but it's more of a discussion. I mean, I think between them and Fox, you know, it's interesting. I mean, it's pretty close as to who made the best fights. It's with DAZN, you're getting value, you're getting volume, you're just getting so many fights. But you're getting up volume at other places. Like when you compare the really big issue, it's that DAZN is $99, and if you paid for all the good fights with Fox, you paid $300. I mean, if they were the same price and maybe $150 or $200, like I'd still probably take DAZN. You know, my guy Kurt Emhoff, he went through and he made a great list. This was before December, and it was like the top 30 or so fights. And DAZN had like 15 or 16 of them. Like Fox had like 9 or 10 of them. And that's why this is really a two-network discussion. You know, you talk about how ESPN did give you some big names and some decent fights on ESPN Plus, but like they had less. I mean, you know, this is really a two-horse race to figure out which was the best network. And I think those are the positives for DAZN. The negatives, you know, so much volume that the inconsistencies were just there, especially at the beginning of the year. I mean, you could make an argument DAZN didn't put on a fight until that April 26 card that was really, like, that impressive at all. But then it came through with two really impressive stretches, especially towards the end of the year. I mean, there's just so many great fights there. There is, that kind of leads me into like there's this experimentation with them, which can be good and bad. And it kind of rears its head in different forms. I mean, we saw several new production ideas that get tried for the broadcast throughout the year. They changed up their broadcast team. They would try different things in between fights. Like they did shoulder programming, but kind of gave it out to the world that rather than make it exclusive on their platform. They did fights with YouTubers. They did all kinds of fights with international fighters in different parts of the world at different times of the day. I mean, depending on your outlook, these can all be positive and negatives. I still think they have some work to do on the production side in terms of how the ring and the lighting looked. But I liked how quickly they moved on from Sugar Ray Leonard. You know, the announcing team, I think, you know, Showtime, I think, still has the strongest team. I think everybody else, there's just positives and negatives. And I didn't really get it onto the other ones because I guess I'm talking about this through the vein of experimentation. And they made good strides, but there were still some inconsistencies. You know, I don't think they did a great job on shoulder programming for the big fights. Like, it did all look good and it looked pretty slick, but they're just trying different things and some of it worked, some of it didn't work for me. I mean, you know, they don't do any real shoulder programming for hardcore fight fans unless it's like the early on stuff where Mannix is interviewing other journalists, which, I mean, to Fox's credit, their Inside PBC show kind of became a pretty decent show to watch by the end of the year. Like, they started to get that down. When you talk about the YouTuber fights, like, I don't really mind the YouTuber fights if it helps their subscriber numbers. Like, this isn't sacrosanct religious territory for me. I like the international events. I mean, I'll be honest, though, on those, they really need to improve their tune-in. So you kind of, in fact, they need to do this everywhere. They really need to improve their version of, as a fight fan, you know when to tune in for the fights that actually matter on the fight card. Some of the negative stuff, I mean, I don't think it's really a negative, but they relied on the World Boxing Super Series again, like, you know, for so much of those fight of the year types. We don't know if the World Boxing Super Series is coming back next year. I'll talk about that more next episode. But that's just something looking ahead where you're like, ooh, there might be a little bit of issues on the horizon because of how much they relied on the World Boxing Super Series. You know, they obviously relied heavily on Goldboy Cano. This is another thing I'll talk about next. You know, this was drama this year, and it kind of forced a couple major issues. I will leave it at that. That has all been really well covered by this podcast and in many other places. But DAZN has made it clear they're all in on boxing in 2020 and that they need to rely on certain entities to deliver, like Canelo and perhaps Golden Boy still. You know, we don't know really what's happening after that. Again, that's kind of a next episode thing. Perhaps my biggest critique of DAZN is the same thing I said earlier about ESPN Plus. It just manifested itself worse on DAZN than in any other place with the Canelo Kovalev card, which is just like, this is a streaming, you know, you're streaming boxing. Like, there's no lead in, there's nothing to worry. Just do it the way you want to do it. And that's a major ding. Like, that's a major ding. I still think just for the value of DAZN, in terms of not having to pay for pay-per-view, this has got to be an A-minus. Even with all this weird stuff, it's like, this has got to be an A-minus. Like, they just delivered so many great fights. You know, if you're going to ding them again, kind of like I said on the tune-in, like, we got to figure that out. There's got to be a better way to figure out when the fights that you care about are coming on. And I don't know what it is. That's for these guys to figure out. Last year, for me, Showtime gave us one of the best non-pay-per-view schedules we've seen in like over a decade, probably. And this year, I think DAZN gave us a better schedule than that. It was not as curated, which in this area is important given how much boxing there is out there and how valuable your time is as a boxing fan. I do really appreciate the places that curate the content rather than just sort of vomit it all out. But DAZN just did a really impressive job for this. So if I'm ranking them, which I guess I am based on my grades, I'd say DAZN was the best value to consumers. Fox was the second best value. ESPN was third, and Showtime was fourth. I wrote an article for Ring Magazine that came out in their January issue of 2019 where I predicted it'd be an incredible year for fight fans just based on all the competition that exists right now in the sport for eyeballs. And in my next episode, I'll get into how I feel about 2020. But let me just say, there was a moment around April where I was really worried that I'd look like a complete idiot after writing that article. It's not going to be the case. I mean, this is going to be one of the best years we've had in the sport in a long time. And a lot of that is due to the money coming in and just the competition that's out there. And I think one of the things I'll preview, I think 2020 is going to shift because of the intense competition. While there's been excellent boxing, there have been very few breakthrough events, which is one of the things I was talking about with the pay-per-view. There just weren't. And there weren't events that really broke through. And there's some of that's just because there's so much volume and we have to adjust this new reality of having so much to keep up with. You know, that comes down to one of the issues I've been hitting on. It's just lack of curation that we were just so spoiled with it with HBO and Showtime, and now are spoiled with a different issue. Rather than only having fights 2 or 3 weeks, you know, weekends at most during the year, now we've just got it every single weekend. But if you can get through some of the duds, and if you can become a smarter fan, I mean, this is just, you're never going to get this again. I mean, we're probably going to get this in 2020, I don't know what's going to happen in 2021. And certainly by 2022, there's going to be another seismic shift, and there will not be four major networks doing boxing. But for right now, enjoy it while it lasts. And hopefully improvements can be made in the weak spots, but enjoy this while it lasts, because it's not going to last forever. All right. Short preview section. There's no action at all on January 4th this weekend, so nice little break. That's why part of the reason why I'm recording this so late on Thursday night. But let's move on. Friday, January 10th from Atlantic City and on Showtime, Clarissa Shields fighting Ivana Habazin for vacant WBC, WBO women's junior middleweight titles. Also on the card, Jerron Ennis fighting Bakhtir Yubayov at welterweight. Ennis is a big-time prospect, and he's not really signed with a big-time promoter right now or a network, so I find it really interesting that anytime he's fighting, I'm watching. Let's put it that way. On Saturday, January 11th, two cards of notes from San Antonio and on DAZN. We have Jaime Munguia versus Spike O'Sullivan at middleweight, where Munguia is making his debut. Also on the card, Franchon Cruz DAZN is fighting Alejandra Jimenez for a women's superweight title. And then from Atlantic City and on ESPN, we have, you know, some pretty good fights. I mean, maybe a little bit lesser profile, but pretty good fights. Jesse Hart fighting Joe Smith Jr. at light heavyweight over 10 rounds. Steve Nelson fighting Chem Killick, 10 rounds super middleweight. Pretty good stuff coming up. Usually we always start slow in boxing at the beginning of the year. And I guess that's one of the reasons why I'll be waiting a little bit on my preview episode next week. Odds on all these cards, just throwing it out there. Clarissa Shields is a huge favorite, which you would expect. Jerron Ennis is like between 20 and 30 to 1 as a favorite in most places. Jesse Hart about 4 to 1, 5 to 1 over Joe Smith Jr. And then Jaime Munguia is like all over the place. As low as 16 to 1, as high as 33 to 1. But come later in January and then come February, we're going to have some other good fights. I hope this episode isn't too laborious. It's certainly a pain for me to put together. So if you guys think this is just me rambling on and listing fights unnecessarily, let me know. I will not do it next year because it is a pain to put together. Anyways, thank you, thank you, thank you. This is my second year doing this podcast. I have a wonderful time doing it. I had a wonderful time doing it this second year. We have a lot more listeners than when we started, and by a significant margin. I appreciate all the people that listen and give feedback one way or the other. I love doing this, and it's going to be a fun year upcoming. I think 2020, again, like I said, this is going to be another great year for boxing. And I actually think because of the pressure on places to succeed, we're going to see a lot. We're going to see more of these bigger events that are going to break through. So I'll talk about that next episode. I got another couple, one or two evergreen episodes planned on coming up after that, but we'll see what comes up. There's a lot of stuff brewing that will just be fun to talk about once it's there. All right. Take care, guys. Talk to you in 2 weeks. Happy New Year.
Did you get what you was looking for?